We Made This.
Hi, my name's Chris Owens. I played Jeffrey Spender on The X-Files, and I'm happy to be talking on the X-Cast.
And welcome to the X-Cast. The truth is in here. My name is Kurt North, and I am your host for this very special feature edition of the X-Cast. I have with me a marvellous star, a guest star who appeared on the X-Files in both the fifth and sixth season, and that is Veronica Cartwright. Hello, Veronica. How are you doing today?
I'm doing really well. Thank you very much.
We're recording on the day of the Biden win, aren't we? So we've,
yes, it was just announced a couple of hours ago. So I mean, we needed Pennsylvania and we got it. So it's exciting here. It's actually raining, which is totally bizarre for LA. I mean, but it's on and off, and the sky did brighten up. So maybe it was just in the morning.
No, so many thanks for coming onto the show. I said off air to yourself that we are currently in the middle of, or just beginning season six, our season six run at the time of recording. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we felt that, obviously, we've had the likes of Chris Owens on and William B. Davis and the like in the past. And we thought that, obviously, you're quite a really big component on those two seasons. So it's a pleasure to have you on. And thank you for coming on to the show.
Thank you. I mean, and yes, to be the ex-wife of the cigarette smoking man, that was thrilling to find out. I didn't know that in the beginning. When we started season five, I didn't know I was married to him.
Right. Okay. I'm sure we'll talk about that as we go on. But just before we do that, there's a few things that both has been on our Facebook group and a couple of things that I would like to ask you regarding your career and just how long and great career that you've had. And I think, first of all, it was news to me. I actually found out through just doing a quick bit of research before we came on that you're actually from Bristol. So originally born in Bristol, so a fellow UK person. So I just wanted to just get an idea of how did you end up to being where you are and in the films that you've been in, you know, when you were turning 11 to 13 into 1979 and Alien. How did that transpire? What was the journey from Bristol to there?
When I was about four and a half, we emigrated. My dad always wanted to come to Los Angeles, but you had to be sponsored. So we went to Canada for 2 years. We came over on the Queen Elizabeth, actually. And we were in Toronto for a couple of years and then immigrated in 55 when I was like six and a half. And we drove cross country and ended up in Los Angeles. And my mother didn't know how to meet people. And our landlady said that the lady down the hall, her daughter was a model, did modeling. Maybe she wanted to talk to her. So she did. What possessed my mother to do this? I have no idea. Anyway, we ended up with an agent called Lola Moore, who used to do these massive casting calls. And the first thing we went up for was somebody up there likes me with Pierre Angeli. I don't even know why I got on it, but Angela was on it, and she was three and a half and got the part. So that sort of started things, and then we did modeling, and my sister Angela, of course, and you know, who did Sound of Music,
yeah. and all that kind of thing.
She was dark and I looked totally all American. I mean, I had thousands of freckles and long blonde hair. And so I became like the Kellogg's girl, cornflakes and Rice Krispies and things like that. And, I ended up, my first movie was The Children's Hour and, with Shirley MacLaine and Audrey Hepburn and J. James Garner. So it was, that was a wonderful experience. I mean, I'd done television. I'd been Leave It to Beaver's girlfriend, Violet, and who gave Beavis first kiss. I don't even know if you get Leave It to Beaver over there. So I'd done a lot of television stuff and commercials, and so that was my first sort of big movie. And I guess Alfred Hitchcock saw it and requested meeting me for The Birds. So I went in to meet him, and it was hysterical because he found out I was from Bristol, and I guess there's a really great wine cellar place where you can store wine and stuff.
Right.
So he started describing great wines. Well, I was 12. I mean, I went, uh-huh. I wish I had that list now. He told me how to cook a steak because someday I'd be getting married and I would need to know this stuff. I mean, it was just sort of like small talk. I mean, it was the most interesting thing. And then I ended up getting on The Birds and never felt intimidated by him. I mean, he would always wear his three-piece suit, and I could ask any questions. And I guess that was what the set it off was, that first interview with him, where we just talked about stuff. So when I would get a little confused, like, how do the birds get on there? Aren't people going to know there's fake birds and real birds? And he goes, your eye sees movement and you assume everything is alive. And it's totally true. I mean, to this day, I can watch that jungle gym scene and I don't know which are the fake birds and which are the live ones. You think you know, and then all of a sudden they move. So, it was just an incredible experience. It was really great. From that, I went immediately into Spencer's Mountain, which was Henry Fonda and Maureen O'Hara, and I was one of the kids. James MacArthur was, I was the teenager who, you know, saw him kissing the the girl, and of course I had to tattle on him. I was a big tattletale. And from that, I ended up doing this Xerox special called Who Has Seen the Wind, which I really wished they would re-release it. I don't know why. It was Stanley Baker and Theodore Bickel and Maria Schell and Edward G. Robertson. And it was this incredible story on a boat with refugees who had no place to go. They'd sort of be shuffled around and...
Well, that would be very kind of contemporary now, wouldn't it?
I know. I thought it would be perfect timing because the whole thing was I was coming of age where I just take showers on the back of the boat and all these men were leering at me. And so Maria Scala came in. She was the nun who rescued me off the boat. And so it was just an incredible non-dated piece. So I'm not quite sure why they never showed it again. So, and from that, I mean, I was just really lucky. I just kept working. I ended up getting the Daniel Boone series.
Yeah.
I had been up for a part that Heather Urich got in The Sound of Music as Louisa. I went back several times, and of course my sister ended up being Brigitte, and I went over to Austria with them, but the casting man said, don't worry about it, I have you in mind for something else, and it ended up being Daniel Boone. So my dad and my brother and I came back from Austria, and I went to Utah and shot Daniel Boone. And then, so I did that for a couple of years, and then I was when I was released from that, I wasn't old enough to play mature women, and I wasn't young enough to look like the child anymore. So there was a few years of lull in my career there, and then it started up again, and I started doing some TV, and then I ended up getting Going South with Jack Nicholson and Mary Steenburgen's first movie, and that was a hoot and a half. We shot that in Durango, Mexico,
Right.
And it was just, I mean, it was Christopher Lloyd and Danny DeVito. It was all the Cuckoo's Nest people that were on that show. I mean, and John Belushi's first movie.
Oh, right.
And
okay.
Then from that, I got Invasion of the Body Snatchers, and then I went to Alien, and I've just been really fortunate getting really great parts, and I loved Cassandra Spender. I just thought she was a fabulous character to get to play. And, of course, being in the wheelchair and having the same thing in the back of my neck as Scully had, and that whole thing where I'd been captured by the aliens. And then when they come back in season 6, I can walk.
Yeah, it's some journey, isn't it? Some journey.
I know. And when they did the movie, I called Chris and I said, oh, I want to be in it. I'm half alien, half human. Please let me be in it. But unfortunately, that didn't work out. But who knows? Maybe one day they'll do another X-Files. There seems to be a big resurgence for some reason. I'm not quite sure why. People are locked in houses, I guess, looking at X-Files.
So before we get into the X-Files stuff in any deeper, there's a couple of things that was mentioned and a couple of interesting things that I'd like to ask you specifically on some of the films you've mentioned. So like to the children's hour, I mean, that deals with lesbianism, especially with the time of year that was made. Was there any kind of dissenting voices or anyone actually at the time were on set with regards to that film? It's just something I was keen to get your opinion on. Or
it was interesting because a lot of people pulled their children out of the movie once they realized that it had lesbianism. My mom had got us enlisted with these two guys. One was a drama coach, and the other one was did musical theater stuff.
Yeah.
And they were a couple, Frank Weika and Bill Lockwood, and we just became friends. He used to, Frank used to go over the parts with me, like he'd gone over me with me for the children's hour, reading the lines, making sure I got things down and stuff like that. So when the whole thing came up, I mean, I was in Catholic school. I did 12 years of Catholic school. My mom, I can't believe it. She actually said, well, this is just like Frank and Bill, only two women. I'd been over and had lunch. They seemed perfectly fine to me. So it didn't even occur to me that it was something weird. So the kiss is what actually made it, you know, when I saw them kissing. That was so obviously a lie, but being a kleptomaniac, I mean, that became more important, and I was forced into telling that lie, which totally ruined their lives. But to work on it, I didn't occur to me that there was anything really wrong. The same kind of normal. And there was a brilliant poster that was put out that actually somebody sent me, and then there was a whole thing on the Children's Hour, a documentary actually done on the Children's Hour. This poster was like magenta color, and the two women looking at each other in black and white, and all it said at the top was different. Brilliant. What a brilliant poster.
Yeah, it makes such much sense, doesn't it?
All it said was just different. I mean, it was just incredible. So I was thrilled to be part of that. I mean, working with William Wyler was intense. I mean, he was terrific. It was a really great experience, and Shirley MacLaine sort of took me under her wing. She was the first one to come over to me after I was like so hysterical I couldn't breathe. My mother was 8 months pregnant. They said if she'd have seen me at that state, she would have probably had my brother at that point. And Shirley MacLaine came over and hugged me and said, oh, that was wonderful, honey, and got me into a Faye Bainter's dressing room. In those days, they were plywood dressing wheels that were on wheels, and they were right there on the stage, and they brought me ice, and, you know, I mean, it was just an incredible experience. And years later, I realized how much of an influence Shirley MacLaine had had on me. I mean, my first meeting with her was, of course, everything was done on film. And so it was like a wardrobe. And she was standing on sort of like a raised thing so that the cameraman could take pictures of her. And she was just sort of turning around, but the cast and the crew, and she was just, I mean, all the crew were there and she was joking with them. And I sitting there waiting for my turn, I thought, oh, that's what, you know, how cool is that? I mean, she was just so unaffected. She was just, I thought she was fabulous. Anyway, years later, I was doing a play, and it was on Hollywood and Vine, and they always had the Christmas parade, and so we were shut down because it was the Hartford stage, the Doolittle it was changed into. And so I thought, oh, Shirley MacLaine, she's doing a one-woman show down on Wilshire. I'm going to go and see the show, which was fantastic and amazing. And, I mean, what a talent that woman is. And so I decided to go backstage to say hi, and the guy at the, you know, at the door says, well, does she know you or know you're coming? I said, no, but I did a movie with her, The Children's Hour, and I would just wondered if I could see her. Well, the next thing I know, they go, come, Veronica, and Shirley's standing there, and she says to me, oh my gosh, I have followed your career. I thought, oh my God, that was just incredible. I went into her dressing room, and of course, she had her book out, and all about dreams, and all of that stuff, and past lives. And I said, well, I had a dream, and you were in it, because you were sort of my mentor for why I do what I do. I mean, it was just, it was such a wonderful sort of kudo to, you know, a tap to everything. It was great.
Yeah, well, that was one of the questions I was going to ask you actually about people who have influenced your career, because throughout your career, you've had people like Shirley MacLaine, but you've obviously Hitchcock. Has anything lasting over the years that you feel that there's a piece of advice that he may have given you? But you've also had people like, you know, Ridley Scott, for example. I mean, Ridley Scott actually went to school near to where I am at the moment, strangely enough. But you've got Ridley Scott and even Kaufman and people like that that you've worked through throughout your career.
Phil Kaufman is just a dream to work with. And what a lovely, lovely human being. He is just a sweetheart. And so I did Invasion of the Body Snatchers with him. And then years later, I did The Right Stuff, playing Betty Grissom. And I went, of course, I had to meet with Chartoff and Winkler, and they were the producers. Well, I had been in a serious car accident in 1981 where I broke 35 bones in my ankle, and so I had all this metal in there. I mean, nowadays they put you in a soft cast, but at that time they put you in a cast
with
your thigh to above your knee to below, and it literally was like 6 months. And I had just gotten that off. My mother actually drove me to the interview, and Phil came out of the door. And I had been practicing going up and down stairs so I didn't look like I had a limp. Oh, my God. Okay. So I danced down the hall. And I go, hey, Phil, how you doing, babe? And I thought, this way. And I just prayed that when I left, he wouldn't come out to say goodbye because I was limping. Oh, my God. When I got the part, he told me that he had written the part with me in mind, which was just wonderful. I mean, Betty was an incredible character, and to be involved in the movie was so wonderful. And then I did another movie. He called me to do Wisdom, which was with Ashley Judd. And he said, come on, because you've never gotten to go to Chez Panisse. We had been invited to go to Chez Panisse when we first got Invasion of the Body Snatchers, and that was the year that it burnt down. So, it was during The Right Stuff. That's right. doing the right stuff that had burnt down, so he couldn't take us all there. So he invited me to go back up so I could go to Chez Panisse.
Oh, God.
Oh, my gosh, it's so sweet. And it ended up being my girlfriend's birthday, so I took her to Chez Panisse for her birthday. And it was fantastic. And the weirdest thing is M. Night Shyamalan was sitting right next to us with his family. Oh, right. I mean, it was, I didn't say anything, but it was very cool. It was like having a private dinner, and like the food was incredible. To this day, I wish I knew how to do that appetizer of swordfish that was like crispy on the outside. It was a quarter of an inch thick, but so moist. Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. Okay. So
fantastic.
Anyway, Phil's fabulous. Ridley was interesting. He gets so into what he's doing. He doesn't really, he hired people he knew would be able to do what he needed, so he didn't have to worry about us. He is so concentrated on what the art was and that what it looks like, and you know, talking to the cameraman, that we would just sort of like, oh well, do that again and do this, like the slap across the face when I slap a Sigourney.
Yes.
Every time I went to slap her, she would duck, and my instruction was just get her this time. So I said, oh, okay. So what you see is me going, and then I backhanded her, and she went right into it, and oh, she was pissed off. Ooh. but I got her.
Well, yeah, no, that was the main thing. As long as you get her, that's the main thing that you need to, you know, that was in the script. You've got to do it.
That's right. It was, but these were his instructions. Or he'd tell Yaphet Kotter, make her pissed off. So, of course, that was, you know, easy for Yaphet to do. He kept coming in, and when she becomes captain of the ship because of the Dallas gets killed, Tom Skerritt, he literally was like going, come on, don't tell me that you're captain of the ship. I'm captain of the ship. He goes, no, I'm 265 pounds. I'm black as can be, and I have a huge following. So you better tell me. I mean, he just kept pushing and pushing and pushing. It was pretty amazing. Right. And the final take, of course, she does that. And he literally puts the gun down and says, okay. And he was like, brilliant. But this was how Ridley directed. I mean, he didn't talk to us much. He was just confident that we would do what
needed to do. The job he needed to do.
Yeah. But I mean, he must have gotten more personal, like when he started doing Thelma and Louise and more personal stuff. That must have changed. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, I know that he had troubles on the Blade Runner set as well. I think there was some issues on there with the crew and stuff. So.
Harrison Ford, I guess, used to write messages and hand it to the AD, and then they used to hand it to Ridley. I mean, oh, God.
Yeah, exactly. It must have been horrible to work in that environment. But it goes without saying that people would want to ask about the chest bursting scene, because it's obviously just that iconic. I think the question I would ask is that we're aware, obviously, that the blood spurt came out and it wasn't exactly where it wasn't. You weren't anticipating that, but can you remember before you got into doing that scene, knowing what was to come, what you felt like before actually it began and until the point of the blood spurt?
Well, actually, we were up in dressing rooms for hours while they were setting John up. And but we didn't know, we knew there was going to be a chest bursting scene because it was in the script, but we didn't know how it was going to be done exactly. And when they finally called us to come in, we were in, everything was surrounded by plastic. Everybody had like raincoats on, and the smell of awful in the car, oh, it was just horrendous. I'm on this formaldehyde smell. It just made you gag as you walked into this tent of plastic, and there's John with just his torso sticking out. He'd been there for hours. I don't know what kind of chair he was sitting in, but it wasn't very comfortable. And of course, he was all stuffed with guts and, you know, livers and all sorts of stuff. I was told I would get a little blood on me.
Yeah.
And I said, oh, okay. Well, you know, but I got, we started and we shut, we started the first take and we became so fascinated by watching John and whatever it was coming through. Now, I must say, Sigourney and I had gone down to the puppet shop where they had made the penis man. We, because we had to do a scene after, we didn't even know what we were talking about.
Right.
So they took us out. Oh, God, they were so excited. They couldn't be breathing. And then you see this, the teeth will go in and out. And I mean, it was like they were so, so excited about, you know, and they had like pumps and stuff. So it looked like it breathed and then it would be turning its head. And oh, my gosh, it was just that. And we saw it in the early stages before it was actually colored and stuff like that. But at least we knew what we were talking about. Mm. So we knew that was going to be in there. But we became so fascinated by watching this thing. And the T-shirt, they hadn't quite put enough incisions into it so that it would be able to burst through. So Ridley shouts, cut. And they go in and they sort of use a little razor blade X-Acto knife to cut the T-shirt again so that it can burst through. Well, I mean, every time, all of this was just building tension and tension. And so then all of a sudden, I leaned right into a blood jet. And it came out. And I got just soaked. And that's why I go, oh my God. I mean, I just leaned right damn into the damn thing. I was so fascinated watching. I mean, it was just like, well, of course, that was the take they used. I mean, but I backed up and I hit that banquette that was back there. And I flipped over the top of the seat of the damn thing. And all there was, and I must say, it was hysterically funny, two cowboy boots sitting up. But I could tell that they were still working. So I rolled out. I come running around the banquette and I get back in there. I mean, here I am just totally covered in blood. And I must say, it was the outtakes when we went up and we saw it. It was really funny. God, it looked like a Max stand-up movie. All of a sudden, I'm da-da-da-da, and then I just disappear. And there's two cowboy boots sitting there. It was very, very funny.
I mean, the one scene that doesn't get as much attention, though, is the Ash Robot one, because that was 3 years before The Thing, and it has that kind of thought to it. I mean, do you remember much about the Ash Robot attacking scene as well, because that itself is quite for me anyways, quite memorable, and it is quite gory, and well, with all the milk and things going out of it.
When his head is on the table,
yeah,
we had all done that scene with him, and it was incredibly moving, the scene, because he asked us if anybody had tried to deal with it. Because the way the alien was explained to us in the very beginning was it was kind of like a big deer, and this was, you know, it was like growing up. So what I thought was like, all of a sudden there's this fawn, and you're trying, nobody did bother to try and deal with it. Who knows? Maybe it was nice, but it was so ugly that nobody tried to deal with it. And that was part of the speech that Ash gave. I mean, it was extremely emotional, I thought. And then all of a sudden, Ridley goes, oh, I hate these fucking beads. Well, the beads were these pieces of, you know, the silver balls that they put on candy, I mean, on top of cakes, and there were grapes, and there was milk was what was pouring out of him. But, I mean, I was totally caught up in Ian's speech, and then he's worried about the little pieces of balls that are on cake. Then I found out that, like, 3 months later, Ian had to go back in and redo it. And of course, none of us were there. Most of us had gone back to America. So he did the whole scene with none of us. And of course, it changed that sort of aspect of it if had we tried to deal with it, that maybe it wasn't as heinous as it ended up being. And when I first saw the movie, I was a bit pissed off that that element wasn't there. But, of course, the movie became such a classic and everybody loves it. And it was, you know, a great group of people. Years later, I worked with the guy that actually, the special effects guy, I worked with him on a movie where he goes, "I'm sorry that you got so much blood on you that day. I was in charge of that."
Yeah, I can only imagine what he was wondering
anyway,
would throw
but
to you.
I just leaned right into it. But it's great that it was just a spontaneous thing, you know?
Yeah.
So that was cool.
Oh, good. Well, okay. Well, let's talk about the X-Files because that's what we talk about.
All right.
So first off, when your character first appears, your character actually spans, you mentioned it there with the film, between X-Files when it was in season 5 over the Vancouver years and obviously season 6, which was when it moved to LA.
Correct.
And at that point, it was a high point of the X-Files career, season 4, season 5 was probably its peak. The film was coming out. Did you watch The X-Files before that? Did you watch it in early doors before it became such a phenomenon? Or?
Yeah, I had watched The X-Files, actually. I had seen it. And what was so interesting is, I guess there's only 13 episodes that are the conspiracy theory, which is what I was part of.
Yeah.
I liked those the best. I mean, I loved the sort of like trying to figure out where the hell they came from and all that stuff. And of course, Chris Carter was so totally into it. There's a whole hospital that deals with people, which of course is how my stuff starts out inside the hospital. And I happen to realize the real estate guy had gone off and he got the chip in his neck and I have that chip. There is actually a hospital where people go. They think that they're of course nuts, but they're all convinced that they went off to live with aliens. And every single one of them who have never met each other describe them in three different ways. There's the grays, which are like, you know, that one with Richard Dreyfuss and Spielberg did. Those are the grays. And these are all coming from actual people's descriptions. There are the gold ones, which are sort of radiate like, you know, Starman with Jeff Bridges. I said, well, if they all look like him, that'd be fine by me. And then there are the ones that drip that oil. And these are all actual descriptions that people have seen. And so I just thought it was so interesting because Cassandra sees all of those, and especially the oil ones, the ones that are dripping that black stuff from their nostrils and stuff when they come to attack us on the bridge. When we did the wheelchair scene where it goes up into space. Actually, that was interesting because I tell you, Vancouver, the people were just so fantastic. I mean, we did all of that stuff out there at the actual dam. And it looks something like out of a Tim Burton movie or the 30s or something. It's sort of this mint green and it's the actual working dam. Well, they lit the whole thing, the PG&E or whatever they are, or the lighting people from that actually work on the dam. They lit the whole thing, and they were turning the water off. One guy said, well, you can't have all this noise behind when we were on the opposite side of the bridge. Well, we'll just turn the dam off. And they would turn the dam off so it wouldn't mess up the dialogue. I mean, they were so incredible. So then when I get to the wheelchair part where I'm supposed to go up, they sent me home and then they had me come back and they actually built a replica of that bridge on a soundstage. And it was a big, huge A-framed soundstage. And they reversed everything. So I was up in the sky, like 20, I don't know how many feet. I was up at the top of this A-frame place. And they set fans up and they would put ivory snow, you know, laundry soap.
Yeah.
They would pour that into it so it looks like that's all that floating stuff. I actually come down with my arms, you know, spread. And then once I got to the seat, I had to sit down and you're there. She's like talking under her breath. Yeah, okay, you're there, because I couldn't see anything. And it was hysterical. She's sort of guiding me so that I know I have to sit, you know, how to sit down and do the thing in reverse. It was hysterically funny. We had to do that one a couple of times. You're out there. You're over there. Breathing under her. It was very funny.
Yeah, it's good there's frivolity on the set. I mean, also as well, I mean, how were you approached? Were you actually approached by the casting team? Was Chris Carter involved?
I went on an interview to 20th Century Fox with tons of other women that were up for it. Oh, no, I read for the part.
And when you did get the part then, and the character, how was the character described for the show? I mean, you mentioned before that the idea of the ex-wife came in the sixth season. It wasn't in the original. But how was it approached to you at the beginning?
Well, I mean, I didn't even know that I had a son. I didn't even know that I had Jeffrey Spender until the second season, on the beginning of season six, I guess it was. I didn't even know that Jeffrey Spender was my son.
Right.
Because the whole thing evolved around meeting Scully and knowing that she had that chip in the back of her neck like I did, and that we were sort of simpatico. Those were the first couple. It wasn't until I was all of a sudden being able to walk, and obviously the aliens had fixed me so that I could walk. And in the second episode, and those were shot back in L.A. I believe it was David had in his contract that after 5 years, he would be able to come back to Los Angeles.
So with that, I mean, just with Cassandra Spender as a whole, I mean, she's really important character for the show. I think I'm with you. I'm part of the reason why I'm interviewing you today is because I'm a huge mythology fan of the show. There's a lot of people who can do both, but also like the Monster of the Week. But the mythology is where I come from.
Actually, it was interesting because, I mean, we shot that just before Christmas.
Right.
And our director was due, Rob Bowen, he was due to go back to over to England to do something, I believe, or back to New York or something. Anyway, he was due to get on a plane. And we were shooting in these incredible places that were built. It was on a marine, on an army base. And these were for harboring dirigibles.
Right.
And I believe it held six. The places were absolutely massive. And the weird thing is the inside was all wood and it had exits all the way across. And the one that we shot in, they can't do anything about it. It's preserved because a white owl lived in there.
Oh,
every once in a while, this white owl would go sweeping down. Anyway, we had to do this stuff where, I mean, they pulled all our faces up and we had wigs on, so we all looked younger and everything like that. It was a lot of stuff didn't work. I mean, one poor actor in it, that when they pulled him up, he was so panicked that to move, because, you know, they put little tabs on you and pull your skin back and everything. He was so panicked about moving. One of the kids came over to me and goes, "Is he an alien?" I said, "No. He's not an alien." So some stuff that he was in, I mean, it had to be cut. And so they sort of limited it. It took several days to shoot, and we were up there in that those incredible things. Mm. And then there was the fire part, too. Yeah. But I don't think I was burned. I don't think I was killed. I think that I'm half alien, half human. That's what I kept saying to Chris. I mean, you know, they wouldn't kill me.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that was one of the questions. And one of the questions on Facebook, actually.
Well, the Davis's character, and he had a Scud missile going up and blowing the entire cabin he was living in. Surely I survived.
Yeah, well, we believe that too. That was one of the questions, actually, on Facebook, actually, because I think that there was rumors that you might have been approached to potentially play Cassandra in the revival seasons. Was that ever on the cards? I know that they went back to a younger Cassandra eventually in the revival seasons, but were you ever approached for the revival stuff?
It was sort of discussed, but nothing happened.
Yeah, but nothing happened.
It's
yeah.
a shame, because I would love to have been in more. The cast and the crews were fabulous. I mean, the cast is hysterical. I mean, David is so rude, you know. he has a very wicked sense of humor. And then lovely Jillian. I mean, she would, because they worked incredible hours. How we did their show. Each show was 11 days to shoot. And what they would do was, after the 7 days, they would literally get another. They would shoot the principal stuff, so that on this, when they had to do 8 days, then it would go over to another cast. But we would stay with the director, and a new director would come on. That way they could get away with shooting these shows, which would take 11 days to shoot.
Yeah.
So it was really fascinating, but she would get the giggles if she was overly tired. And I remember one day there was a scene between her and David, and our director was sitting there, and he was going, oh, no, 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 because we were watching it on the TV monitors in the back. Yeah. And then he's going, oh, no, 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 please don't. Please don't. And then all of a sudden she would just split. I mean, she would kill herself laughing. I don't know what triggered it. But we had to shut down for about 10 or 15 minutes while she could go and collect herself. I mean, it was a hysterical thing. And the two of us, I mean, we would just look at each other and start laughing. And you have no idea what it was.
Yeah, I mean, she's got a great laugh as well, isn't it? We've seen the outtakes of her giggling.
And she's just
amazing.
Lovely. I mean, everybody, considering how hard everybody worked on that show, it was just, I don't know, it was a great cast, a great crew, and of course, Bill Davis, he doesn't even smoke.
No,
I mean,
no.
That was always fascinating. Here he is playing cigarette smoking man, and I guess that's why he devised that kind of 40s sinister holding of the cigarette. So it would, like, you know, smoke would come out because somebody would light it for him. It wasn't even tobacco. It would light it. And here he is. He didn't even smoke.
for you as somebody that watched the show then, because of the way Cassandra was in that show, she was the, as you say, the alien-human hybrid that became everything, that you had real depth discussions with both Mulder because Cassandra saw him as the one to save the world, Scully because they had the joint symbiosis with the chip in the neck, but then you've also got Chris Owens and William B. Davis in there. So you were the centre of that story, and that's why I think that the four episodes that you're in is really important and probably one of the most important reoccurring guests that they've had on. Did you feel that when you were going in as the story became apparent that you have the conversation with William B. Davis when you're on the bed there, you know, arguing him, saying he's a bastard and all that kind of thing? Did you feel that it was such an important role?
Absolutely. I knew it was an important role from the very beginning. I mean, just the fact that they, from the very first script, I mean, you're not, when you go to read something, you're not given a script. You're just, I mean, it's a lovely business. They just give you a few scenes.
Yeah.
And then you do the scene sitting in an office and, you know, people look at you. It's just a weird thing. And of course, now we have to do all our scenes on Zoom by ourselves. I knew she was going to be important. They said that she would be in a couple of episodes, and it would shoot in Vancouver. And then I just think as it progressed, then you would get the script, and you realize what an important character she was. I mean, as I say, I didn't know that Cigarette Smoking Man was my husband until we started the next season.
Yeah.
So all I knew was that she was important because of having that chip in the back of her neck. And I knew that they were going to have to figure out how I got it the same as Scully got it.
Yeah.
And, of course, Scully, she had been in that weird hospital and put, you know, made to they put to sleep and put in that sort of weird coma thing so they could take it out or something.
Yeah.
And they didn't take it out because they were afraid. I don't know. It was like, yeah, I realized that she was an important character. That's why when I realized they were doing the movie, I wanted to be so part of it. You know,
yeah.
I didn't feel that she died. And,
no.
If you know, as I said, if Cigarette Smoking Man could survive having that missile.
Yeah. We have our own. I've got my own personal theory with that, which I mentioned last season, that he was cloned several times when back in Redux at the beginning of season 5. So
that's my
own personal headcanon. But yeah, because there was at the beginning of Redux, Skinner goes into a cloning experiment. Debate, and I've always said that the log cabin that they go and get Cigarette Smoking Man from, it's just a factory line of Cigarette Smoking Men. But
you know, when they gave birth to that baby, I thought maybe it was Cassandra.
Right.
Because they never showed the face of the person.
No, they didn't, did they? That's a very good point.
I thought, well, maybe I was the one who was giving birth to this weird whatever half alien thing or this alien. I mean, it ran through my mind. Why wouldn't that be possible? They never showed the face of the person.
No, and I'm sure we'll debate that in the Facebook group when this comes to air. So yeah, we'll make it canon. We'll make it canon, Veronica. Yeah, absolutely.
So, but no, it was a great experience. I love doing it, and so maybe they'll do another one. Who knows? They said that they keep saying, "Oh, that was the last one," and then something happens, and so maybe these things will spur them on.
Yeah, absolutely. The one thing again, just before we move on, just to the social media stuff as well, is the what I particularly like about your character as well was. At the end, you mentioned about the fire, the bridge scene. Oh, both of your cliffhangers are really memorable because it goes to black and all you can hear is the fire and the burning on the first episode. And in the second one, there's people from your character arc, there's people that want to kill you. There's people that want to give you to the aliens. There's other people, there's yourself wanting to kill yourself by asking Mulder to kill you.
Right.
So there's so many things going on. You're shouting, kill me now. And I think that both of those moments are kind of memorable in the X-Files history, which is marvelous, as I say, for the fact of just being in the 4 episodes. It's such a great character to be in. How was it like with your scenes with Chris Owens then? Because he seems to be such a lovely guy. I've spoken to him at X-Fest.
Yeah, he was just lovely. He's a really great guy, Chris Owens. I tell you, everybody on that show was just great.
Yeah.
Chris, I don't know, he was just a really giving actor. He was really fun, and he was lovely. I mean, I really liked him. And then, of course, he came back. He ended up coming back.
Yeah, he got shot in the face. So if he can get shot in the face, you can easily come back.
Why the hell couldn't I come back? Oh, we need to be talking about this. Maybe they do a Cassandra movie.
Oh yes, well we'll work on that. We'll get the fan fiction people out, and we'll send you a copy. Well, thank you very much for coming on. We need to talk about the social media, some of the questions that came on to our Facebook group, and we'll do that now before we finish up. Right, okay, so let's look at the social media. Some of the questions that I have already asked has been mentioned already, so we'll skip over those ones. But Paige Schechter was the first one up, and she asked about the questions she always tends to ask people. What was it like working with Kim Manners? And as a follow-up to that, how was it different from working with Rob Bowman and Chris Carter? How were the three changed, and especially Kim Manners, because he's such beloved by the fan base?
Well, Kim Manners was the one that he was wonderful. I mean, and he would get so excited, and he was he would always go action. He would get so excited, it would lift him off the ground, you know, action. He was just, oh my God, he was hysterical. And he's the one who was worried about Jillian starting to laugh. He was sitting there going, oh, no. But I thought Kim Manners, it was so sad. He was so young when he died.
Yeah, it was.
That was so, very sad. Kim Manners was, he was just totally enthusiastic. I mean, he loved what he was doing, but I mean, you could always action. I mean, it was hysterical. And Chris Carter is like just totally Mr. Mellow, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he's just, he was just lovely. And he was the one who told me all about the hospital and the different kinds of aliens. And he asked me if I believed in aliens. See, I believe that we're an incredibly selfish bunch of people to believe that we're the only existing element. Every time they find like water or something on the moon or Mars or something like that, I mean, I go, okay, now they found something. Yeah. I mean, it's just, it seems to be incredibly selfish that we're the only people. So maybe they do walk amongst us. I don't put anything, and too many weird things, you know? Things that are classified and ships that they find and I don't know, particles and weird stuff. I mean, it just seems incredibly selfish of us to believe that we're the only people.
Yeah. So Chris Carter was actually he seems to be one of those people that he wants to know everything, and he kind of develops that information and keeps things in his head to mill over and actually put into the page, doesn't he? So
absolutely, because that was what my whole stuff was based on. And then Rob Bowen is just, I mean, he's a character and a half. Now, it was so interesting because Rob Bowen went on to do Castle.
Yes.
And I remember going on an interview to play his Fallion's mother, Nathan Fallion's mother. And when I went on the interview, this guy at the end comes over to me and he goes, I'm Rob Bowen. You don't recognize me, do you? Well, when I worked with Rob, he had really long hair and he was quite heavy. And here was this thin person with a crew cut. I didn't recognize him at all. And as a matter of fact, when I left going, Rob Bowen? I mean, it was so hard for me to put the two together. Yeah. That they were, I mean, totally different people.
So moving on to the next one then. So Christian Villacorte says he would like to know your thoughts on how do you perceive the motivations of Cigarette Smoking Man and the Alien Syndicate conspiracy back in the day and Cassandra's worth as the ultimate alien-human hybrid? I would add a second question to that because Cigarette Smoking Man was always saying, I was doing it to protect you, I was doing it for you, but he put your character through so much hardship from 1973 to whatever year that was, 1999.
Yeah.
But his thoughts are, what do you think of Cigarette Smoking Man's motivations?
Well, I just think he was a horrible person. It was awful. I mean, the stuff he did was just terrible. And you know, you can sit there and say, oh, I'm doing it for you. But, I mean, look what he did. He killed our son, we thought. He was just an awful, awful, selfish person. And it was all part of that, like, conspiracy group that there was. I don't know. Frankly, I didn't believe him. Cassandra believed him at all. I mean, you know, look at her there at the end. I mean, his character was despicable. Yeah. I mean, he was
an
awful person. Terrible. He's a lovely person in real life, but such a terrible character. He had so much fun with it, you know, because they would, deviate, and they'd go off, and then they'd have sort of a chuckles show, a show where they would have funny aliens or whatever. I mean, to break the mood. I mean, I was only part of the conspiracy theory, but Bill, they would go to Bill and ask him, because they would lose track of what they were doing or what they were writing about. And they would go and ask him. He had it entirely chronological, exactly what was happening at what time.
So he should have been holding the Bible then. He was the Bible holder.
And something would be wrong, and Bill would go in and tell them, no, this happened at this time, and you can't be doing this now. I mean, he literally kept like a chronological thing of the entire thing, so nobody went off track. I mean, Bill would tell them when they were wrong.
Yeah. Well, that's good to know that. That's good, because we've had Bill on the podcast before, and Tony, the show, one of the showrunners, he spoke to him a couple of times actually, and so it's been and after the revival seasons as well. Once the reveals there were brought up, and it was interesting talking to him about those shows. I mean, what did you make to the revival ones? Given aside that Cassandra's just in the background, you know, she's just walking around the planet as an alien human hybrid. But what did you make to the new seasons? Was there any particular ones that you enjoyed?
Well, I mean, I liked some of them, but I thought some of them got really jokey and sort of away from. See, I like the more serious ones. I liked it when they were more serious. I mean, I ended up not watching the entire seasons. I mean, I sort of got frustrated. I mean, some of them were really silly. Yeah. I thought.
Did you? So with regards to the film, just while I'm thinking about this as well, the actual X-File film, there's a lot of callbacks to Alien as it happens, especially with the type of creature it is. There's some musical cues to that, and it is interesting how Alien comes into play throughout the X-Files as well with that. Did you make those two connections up when you saw the X-Files film? That looks very similar to the one in the Xenomorph as well. And
oh yeah, I remember that. Well, now that you're mentioning it, but I at the time I hadn't thought of that. But when you think about it, I mean, from doing Alien, how many creatures? Everybody looked like the alien. I mean, even Godzilla looked like the alien with some spikes on him. And then they did The Abyss, and that head looked, I mean, it was water, but it was just like the alien. I don't think it was until they did that movie Abrams did.
Cloverfield.
No, not
was
Cloverfield.
Cloverfield. No.
It was the, I have this on the tip of my tongue. Not X-Files. Oh, it was the one with the cameras and the kids. That was the first time that anybody sort of got away from what always looked like the alien in any form.
Yeah.
Because I was so tired of every alien looking like our alien. I mean, it was memorable. I mean, our alien was memorable. But even as the Alien series went on, I mean, by the time they, I think, got to the third one, I mean, they looked like sperm swimming through that water. And there were so many.
Yeah, that's true.
And the whole interesting series that Ridley had was that they started getting so big so fast that that's why they had to, you know, propagate. That's why they had to plant into, they had Tom Skerritt, Dallas, up in that cave, and because they had to plant their seed because they grew so fast. So, I mean, that was a hell of a lot of seeds they were planting there if they were all swimming around. And that looked so stupid to me, that whole. I didn't like that one.
But the Super 8 is the film that you're thinking of.
That's it.
For the
8,
which was a great
movie camera. Yeah, Super 8.
Yeah. So one final question on social media, and that brings us to close. And I want to thank you very much for coming on, and we'll talk about some stuff late in a second. But Maciek Gutowski wants to know, and you've already kind of alluded to this anyway, but he asks, did she do any preparations or research for the role for Cassandra? Like, for example, did you read any memoirs of any abductees or anything? Now, you mentioned about the hospital, but did you read any other material outside of the hospital stuff?
I didn't really. No, I didn't. Because, I mean, I just sort of went with what the character was. Having the thing in the back of my neck, I knew from their thing that I had obviously been off into another universe and been brought back down. So I just sort of went from moment to moment. I mean, what I, you know, I knew about whatever 51 and all of those things. But I mean, what research would I do? Because it was happening to me at the moment as a character.
Right, yes, yeah.
So,
yeah.
I'm sorry, Magic, I didn't.
No, that makes sense, though, because as I say, it was happening to you, so you kind of need to have that distance, don't you, for the character, because she doesn't know what's going on. So that's,
we didn't know. I mean, we get our script and you read it and you go, oh, that's what's happening. I didn't realize that I was such an that I had had confrontation with the ones that dripped the oil until I was in the hospital. And then I tell Mueller, I am the one. I know exactly what's happening. It's happened to me. So I tell him that. Well, I wouldn't have known that. I mean, you know, and those were, we'd get our scripts and we'd read them and I'd go, oh, I am the one.
Yeah.
Cool. I was sort of the hybrid and I just, I don't know. That's why I couldn't understand why I never did anymore. I'm easy to work with. I tried.
You are.
You're
easy to work with, and you've been a delight to speak to. I just want to say one final thing with your character as well that I just wanted to mention, that I feel that your role within it had such breadth as well, because you had, you know, the Cassandra by name, by nature, is like obviously the idea of Cassandra. You know, in mythology is kind of like, you know, that you're telling the truth about something that no one wants to believe.
Right.
So I like the fact that they use that name to name Cassandra that. But also the fact that you're involved in so much in the episodes that you appear in. So you've got Sheer Fear. There's, you know, there's Revulsion with Cigarette Smoking Man. There's, you know, the fact that Mulder's being a bit of a petulant child when you first meet him because he's going through his own issues and you have to deal with that. You've got the empathy with Scully and all of that. I think it, for me, and I don't know if you feel this way as well, that it had such a broad range of stuff that you could really work with and you really get your teeth into, because the emotions go from everything from excitement to being peed on the floor, which is one of my favorite lines when you see Mulder for the second time, but then to sheer hate and things. So I do think that the role itself,
was nominated actually both seasons.
Yes.
I really thought I would win for that second season. I was terribly disappointed that I didn't win. I just thought she was such an interesting, in-depth character. I had a ball playing her. I mean, and she was. She was like this emotional sponge. But I did get nominated, so for both seasons separately, so that was nice.
It was, and I think you got an Emmy Award early in your career, didn't you? I believe.
I was very young. I was like 15, and I won an Emmy for a thing called "Tell Me Not" in Mournful Numbers. But I won the Emmy, but I've been nominated three times since, once for ER and then twice for the two seasons of X-Files. But
well, if it was up to me, I would have definitely given you that Emmy without a doubt. Okay, so thank you very much. Hopefully you'll come back onto the show in the future. We would love to have you back on in whatever form we find for you to come on.
All right.
It'd be a pleasure to have you. But in the meantime, is there anywhere people can find you online and anything that you're up to at the moment that you want to highlight for the show?
Well, because of the COVID, I am supposed to start a movie next year, March or April. It's actually about June Ahern. And June Ahern is a woman that who does exist, and she helped the San Francisco Police Department. She was a psychic, or she is a psychic. And
all right, okay.
helped the San Francisco Police Department solve a couple of crimes. So I will be playing June, and so they're just trying to get all of that together. But we won't shoot that until next year because of this pandemic. But I am up for a couple of things, and so crossing fingers that one of them works out, that would be nice. It's all so different now, you know, you don't go on interviews and you can't be like personable or anything like that, or see if they would like it in a different way, because I literally go to somebody who has a camera and a backdrop, and he runs the scene with you, you know. He's an actor also, so he set up a whole thing. And but it's an entirely different ball game. I mean, I was up for something, a series, and it was between me and another lady, and we waited. It was like 5 weeks waiting. And then last Wednesday, I found out they went the other way, which is a shame because that would have been fun and a totally wacky character. But, you know, it is what it is. I just sort of... you can only do so much, but I'm supposed to actually go to London. We were supposed to have gone there June of this year, but now they've changed it to it's either June or July, the big London signing. But
all right, yes.
Yeah, so I will be there. Hopefully the pandemic will be over and people will be able to come out. I had a ball last time I did it. It was really great. And I was able to go up to Liverpool. And my mom and my aunt, they were born in St. Helens, which is in London.
All right, okay.
Yeah, and
yeah, so, I know exactly where you are. I'm not far from there.
She's buried with her parents. And so I tracked down her best friend from school, and it worked out, and I ended up, we ended up going and scattering the ashes, and it was great. It was just, it was terrific. Well, my website is the Veronica-Cartwright.com. That's my website.
Yep.
And you just go to Veesland, V-E-E-S-L-A-N-D, and that's my Twitter account.
Excellent stuff. Well, thank you for coming on to the show. It's very much appreciated. We hope to see you again in next time. I'm sure we can find some way to bring you back onto the show. There's plenty to do still to discuss. Yeah, and so until next time, everyone, just remember, trust no one.
Elsewhere on We Made This. Observing the Pattern, a Fringe podcast.
Yes, and it speaks a little bit to, you know, Walter's mindset now, which is, you know, he's... This is his Peter now.
Yeah, so. That's interesting. And I think the line, what that line is trying to kind of put across is that there may be some behaviour or the way this Walter speaks that's different to Walter.
Right, and that was my thought too. Like maybe just the subtle differences. You know, young Peter notices those things, but it was just a weird way for young Peter to voice those thoughts, I thought. Yeah. So.
Pick a disc.
All of the songs, you know, not thinking about I Write Sins, which like you said, I think everyone knows all the words to that song, whether they want to or not. But when, If I'm cleaning the kitchen or something and London Beckham comes on shuffle, like it amazes me, you know, and we're coming up on 15 years from when that record came out, that I can just like belt out the words without even realizing that I have them like stored away somewhere in my brain. And I think that's because the song flows so well that it sticks with you.
Right in the childhood.
Bit of a twist, wasn't it? That like, well, I think we're going back to it again, but like everyone knew she was Kim Possible. It's like it would make sense as well, because it wasn't like she was even wearing a disguise or anything, and like the whole school knew. But it was that thing of like she can save the day by night, but couldn't ask the boy out.
It's actually quite an original take. Stuff like Puffy. Nobody knew she was the Slayer later on.
I'm glad they sort of got rid of that.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network. The XCast and X-Files podcast was created by Tony Black and is produced and hosted by Carl Sweeney, Sarah Blair and Kurt North.
You can find the podcast on Twitter at the X_cast, on Facebook by typing in the XCast, and in our group, X-Files Basement, the XCast podcast fan group, and on Instagram at the XCast Pod.
Don't forget, you can support the show by becoming a member on Patreon. Our patrons get early access to episodes, behind-the-scenes chats with our hosts and a thriving community of X-Files, and other premium interviews and specials. To find out more and subscribe, you can go to patreon.com/thexcast. That's patreon.com/thexcast.
We are also part of the We Made This podcast network, full of popular culture shows, including our Millennium series, The Time Is Now. You can find all of our shows at our website, wemadethispod.com, or via Twitter at @wemadethispod.
Thanks for listening, and keep watching the skies.